policies on colonization and exploration. One might as well take fistfuls of gold and dump them into the Thames as give them to an adventurer like you, Walter, Kit chortled. Adventurer? You can't step out of your own door in daylight for fear of your creditors. Raleigh's voice shook. You can be such a fool, Kit. Matthew had been following the volleys with increasing amusement. Who are you in trouble with now? He asked Marlowe, reaching for his wine. And how much is it going to cost to get you out of it?
My tailor.
Kit waved a hand over his expensive suit.
The print of a Tamburlaine.
He hesitated, prioritizing the outstanding sums. Hopkins, that bastard who calls himself my landlord. But I do have this. Kit held up the tiny figure of Diana that he had won from Matthew when they played chess on Sunday night. Still anxious about letting the statue out of my sight, I inched forward.
You can't be so hard up as to pawn that bauble for pennies.
Matthew's eyes flickered to me, and a small movement of his hand had me sinking back again.
I'll take care of it.
Marlowe bounded to his feet with a grin, pocketing the silver goddess.
You can always be counted on, Matt. I'll pay you back, of course.
Of course, Matthew, Walter, and George murmured doubtfully.
Keep enough money to buy yourself a beard, though.
Kit stroked his own with satisfaction. You look dreadful.
Buy a beard?
I couldn't possibly have understood correctly. Marlowe must be using slang again, even though Matthew had asked him to stop on my account.
There's a barber in Oxford who's a wizard. Your husband's hair grows slowly, as with all of his kind, and he's clean-shaven.
When I still looked blank, Kit continued with exaggerated patience.
Matt will be noticed looking as he does. He needs a beard. Apparently you are not witch enough to provide him with one, so we will have to find someone else to do it.
My eyes strayed to the empty jug on the elm table. Francoise had filled it with clippings from the garden, sprigs of holly oak, branches from a medlar with their brown fruit resembling rose hips, and a few white roses to bring some color and scent into the room. A few hours ago, I had laced my fingers through the branches to tug the roses and medlars to the forefront of the vase, wondering about the garden all the while. I was pleased with the results for about 15 seconds, until the flowers and fruit withered before my eyes. The desiccation spread from my fingertips in all directions, and my hands tingled with an influx of information from the plants. The feel of sunlight, the quenching sensation of rain, the strength in the roots that came from resisting the pull of the wind, the taste of the soil. Matthew was right. Now that we were in 1590, my magic was changing. Gone were the eruptions of witch fire, witch water, and witch wind that I had experienced after meeting Matthew. Instead, I was seeing the bright threads of time and the colorful auras that surrounded living creatures. A white stag stared at me from the shadows under the oaks whenever I walked in the gardens. Now I was making things wither.
Widow Beaton is waiting, Walter reminded us,
ushering Tom toward the door. What if she can hear my thoughts? I worried as we descended the wide oak stairs.
I'm more worried about what you might say aloud. Do nothing that might stir her jealousy or animosity, Walter advised, following behind with the rest of the school of night. If all else fails, lie. Matthew and I do it all the time.
One witch can't lie to another.
This will not end well, Kit muttered darkly. I'd wager money on it.
Enough!
Matthew whirled and grabbed Kit by the collar. The pair of English mastiffs sniffed and growled at Kit's ankles. They were devoted to Matthew. And none too fond of Kit.
All I said, Kit began, squirming in an attempt to escape.
Matthew gave him no opportunity to finish and jacked him against the wall.
What you said is of no interest, and what you meant was clear enough.
Matthew's grip tightened.
Put him down.
Walter had one hand on Marlowe's shoulder and the other on Matthew. The vampire ignored Raleigh and lifted his friend several more inches. In his red and black plumage, Kit looked like an exotic bird that had somehow become trapped in the folds of the carved wooden paneling. Matthew held him there for a few more moments to make his point clear, then let him drop.
Come, Diana. Everything is going to be fine.
Matthew still sounded sure, but an ominous pricking in my thumbs warned me that Kit just might be right.
God's teeth, Walter muttered in disbelief as we processed into the hall. Is that Widow Beaton?
At the far end of the room, standing in the shadows, was the witch from Central Casting. Diminutive, bent, and ancient. As we drew closer, the details of her rusty black dress, stringy white hair, and leathery skin became more apparent. One of her eyes was milky with a cataract, the other a mottled hazel. The eyeball with the cataract had an alarming tendency to swivel in its socket, as though its sight might be improved with a different perspective. Just when I thought it couldn't get worse, I spotted the wart on the bridge of her nose. Widow Beaton slid a glance in my direction and dipped into a grudging curtsy. The barely perceptible tingle on my skin suggested that she was indeed a witch. Without warning, my third eye fluttered open, looking for further information. Unlike most other creatures, however, Widow Beaton gave off no light at all. She was gray through and through. It was dispiriting to see a witch try so hard to be invisible. Had I been as pallid as that before I touched Ashmole 782? My third eye drooped closed again.
Thank you for coming to see us, Widow Beaton.
Matthew's tone suggested that she should be glad he'd let her into his house.
Master Royden.
The witch's words rasped like the fallen leaves that swirled on the gravel outside. She turned her one good eye on me.
Help Widow Beaton to her seat, George.
Chapman leaped forward at Matthew's command, while the rest of us remained at a careful distance. The witch groaned as her rheumatic limbs settled into the chair. Matthew politely waited as she did so, then continued.
Let us get straight to the heart of the matter. This woman, he indicated me, is under my protection and has been having difficulties of late.
Matthew made no mention of our marriage.
You are surrounded by influential friends and loyal servants, Master Royden. A poor woman can be of little use to a gentleman such as you.
Widow Beaton tried to hide the reproach in her words with a false note of courtesy, but my husband had excellent hearing. His eyes narrowed.
Do not play games with me, he said shortly. You do not want me as an enemy, Widow Beaton. The woman shows signs of being a witch and needs your help.
A witch?
Widow Beaton looked politely doubtful.
Was her mother a witch, or her father a wizard?
Both died when she was still a child. We are not certain what powers they possessed, Matthew admitted, telling one of his typically vampiric half-truths.
He tossed a small bag of coins into her lap.
I would be grateful if you could examine her.
Very well.
Widow Beaton's gnarled fingers reached for my face. When our flesh touched, an unmistakable surge of energy passed between us. The old woman jumped.
So? Matthew demanded.
Widow Beaton's hands dropped to her lap. She clutched at the pouch of money, and for a moment it seemed as though she might hurl it back at him. Then she regained her composure.
It is as I suspected. This woman is no witch, Master Royden.
Her voice was even, though a bit higher than it had been. A wave of contempt rose from my stomach and filled my mouth with bitterness. If you think that, you don't have as much power as the people of Woodstock imagine, I retorted. Widow Beaton drew herself up indignantly.
I am a respected healer, with a knowledge of herbs to protect men and women from illness. Master Royden knows my abilities.
That is the craft of a witch. But our people have other talents as well, I said carefully. Matthew's fingers were painfully tight on my hand, urging me to be silent.
I know of no such talents, was her quick reply.
The old woman was as obstinate as my Aunt Sarah, and shared her disdain for witches like me, who could draw on the elements without any careful study of the witch's craft tradition. Sarah knew the uses of every herb and plant and could remember hundreds of spells perfectly, but there was more to being a witch. Widow Beaton knew that, even if she wouldn't admit it.
"Surely there is some way to determine the extent of this woman's powers beyond a simple touch. Someone with your abilities must know what they are," Matthew said, his lightly mocking tone a clear challenge.
Widow Beaton looked uncertain, weighing the pouch in her hand. In the end, its heaviness convinced her to rise to the contest. She slipped the payment into a pocket concealed under her skirts.
"There are tests to determine whether someone is a witch. Some rely on the recitation of a prayer. If a creature stumbles over the words, hesitates even for a moment, then it is a sign that the devil is near," she pronounced, adopting a mysterious tone.
"The devil is not abroad in Woodstock, Widow Beaton," Tom said. He sounded like a parent trying to convince a child there wasn't a monster under the bed.
"The devil is everywhere, sir. Those who believe otherwise fall prey to his wiles."
"These are human fables meant to frighten the superstitious and the weak-minded," said Tom dismissively.
"Not now, Tom," Walter muttered.
"There are other signs, too," George said, eager as ever to share his knowledge. "The devil marks a witch as his own with scars and blemishes."
"Indeed, sir," Widow Beaton said. "And wise men know to look for them."
My blood drained from my head in a rush, leaving me dizzy. If anyone were to do so, such marks would be found on me.
"There must be other methods," Henry said uneasily.
"Yes, there are, my lord."
Widow Beaton's milky eye swept the room. She pointed at the table with its scientific instruments and piles of books.
"Join me there."
Widow Beaton's hand slid through the same gap in her skirts that had provided a hiding place for her coins and drew out a battered brass bell. She set it on the table.
"Bring a candle, if you please."
Henry quickly obliged, and the men drew around, intrigued.
"Some say a witch's true power comes from being a creature between life and death, light and darkness. At the crossroads of the world, she can undo the work of nature and unravel the ties that bind the order of things."
Widow Beaton pulled one of the books into alignment between the candle in its heavy silver holder and the brass bell. Her voice dropped.
"When her neighbors discovered a witch in times past, they cast her out of the church by the ringing of a bell to indicate that she was dead."
Widow Beaton lifted the bell and set it tolling with a twist of her wrist. She released it, and the bell remained suspended over the table, still chiming. Tom and Kit edged forward. George gasped, and Henry crossed himself. Widow Beaton looked pleased with their reaction and turned her attention to the English translation of a Greek classic, Euclid's Elements of Geometry, which rested on the table with several mathematical instruments from Matthew's extensive collection.
"Then the priest took up a holy book, a Bible, and closed it to show that the witch was denied access to God."
The Elements of Geometry snapped shut. George and Tom jumped. The members of the School of Night were surprisingly susceptible for men who consider themselves immune to superstition.
"Finally, the priest snuffed out a candle to signify that the witch had no soul."
Widow Beaton's fingers reached into the flame and pinched the wick. The light went out, and a thin plume of gray smoke rose into the air. The men were mesmerized. Even Matthew looked unsettled. The only sound in the room was the crackle of the fire and the constant, tinny ringing of the bell.
"A true witch can relight the fire, open the pages of the book, and stop the bell from ringing. She is a wonderful creature in the eyes of God."
Widow Beaton paused for dramatic effect, and her milky eye rolled in my direction.
"Can you perform these acts, girl?"
When modern witches reached the age of 13, they were presented to the local coven in a ceremony eerily reminiscent of Widow Beaton's tests. Witches' altar bells rang to welcome the young witch into the community, though they were typically fashioned from heavy silver, polished and passed down from one generation to the next. Instead of a Bible or a book of mathematics, the young witch's family spellbook was brought in to lend the weight of history to the occasion. The only time Sarah had allowed the Bishop Grimoire out of the house was on my 13th birthday. As for the candle, its placement and purpose were the same. It was why young witches practiced igniting and extinguishing candles from an early age. My official presentation to the Madison Coven had been a disaster, one witnessed by all my relatives. 2 decades later, I still had the odd nightmare about the candle that would not light, the book that refused to open, the bell that rang for every other witch, but not for me. "I'm not sure," I confessed hesitantly. "Try," Matthew encouraged, his voice confident. "You lit some candles a few days ago." It was true. I had eventually been able to illuminate the jack-o'-lanterns that lined the driveway of the Bishop House on Halloween. There had been no audience to watch my initial bungled attempts, however. Today, Kit's and Tom's eyes nudged me expectantly. I could barely feel the brush of Widow Beaton's glance, but was all too aware of Matthew's familiar, cool attention. The blood in my veins turned to ice in response, as if refusing to generate the fire that would be required for this bit of witchcraft. Hoping for the best, I concentrated on the candle's wick and muttered the spell. Nothing happened. "Relax," Matthew murmured. "What about the book? Should you start there?" Putting aside the fact that the proper order of things was important in witchcraft, I didn't know where to begin with Euclid's elements. Was I supposed to focus on the air trapped in the fibers of the paper, or summon a breeze to lift the cover? It was impossible to think clearly with the incessant ringing. "Can you please stop the bell?" I implored as my anxiety rose. Widow Beaton snapped her fingers, and the brass bell dropped to the table. It gave a final clang that set its misshapen edges vibrating, then fell silent.
"It is as I told you, Master Royden," Widow Beaton said with a note of triumph. "Whatever magic you think you have witnessed, it was nothing but illusions. This woman has no power. The village has nothing to fear from her."
"Perhaps she is trying to trap you, Matthew," Kit chimed in. "I wouldn't put it past her. Women are duplicitous creatures."
Other witches had made the same proclamation as Widow Beaton, and with similar satisfaction. I had a sudden, intense need to prove her wrong, and wiped the knowing look from Kit's face. "I can't light a candle, and no one has been able to teach me how to open a book or stop a bell from ringing. But if I am powerless, how do you explain this?" A bowl of fruit sat nearby. More quinces, freshly picked from the garden, glowed golden in the bleak light. I selected one and balanced it on my palm where everyone could see it. The skin on my palm tingled as I focused on the fruit nestled there. Its pulpy flesh was clear to me through the quince's tough skin, as though the fruit were made of glass. My eyes drifted closed, while my witch's eye opened and began its search for information. Awareness crept from the center of my forehead, down my arm and through my fingertips. It extended like the roots of a tree, its fibers snaking into the quince. One by one, I took hold of the fruit's secrets. There was a worm at its core, munching its way through the soft flesh. My attention was caught by the power there, and warmth tingled across my tongue in a taste of sunshine. The skin between my brows fluttered with pleasure as I drank in the light of the invisible sun. So much power, I thought. Life. Death. My audience faded into insignificance. The only thing that mattered now was the limitless possibility for knowledge resting in my hand. The sun responded to some silent invitation and left the quince, traveling into my fingers. Instinctively, I tried to resist the approaching sunlight and keep it where it belonged, in the fruit, but the quince turned brown, shriveling and sinking into itself. Widow Beaton gasped, breaking my concentration. Startled, I dropped the misshapen fruit to the floor, where it splattered against the polished wood. When I looked up, Henry was crossing himself again, shock evident in the force of his stare and the slow, automatic movements of his hand. Tom and Walter were focused on my fingers instead, where minuscule strands of sunlight were making a futile attempt to mend the broken connection with the quince. Matthew enfolded my sputtering hands in his, obscuring the signs of my undisciplined power. My hands were still sparking, and I tried to pull away so as not to scorch him. He shook his head, hands steady, and met my eyes as though to say he was strong enough to absorb whatever magic might come his way. After a moment of hesitation, my body relaxed into his.
"It's over. No more," he said emphatically.
"I can taste sunlight, Matthew." My voice was sharp with panic. "I can see time waiting in the corners."
"That woman has bewitched Awech. This is the devil's work," Widow Beaton hissed.
She was backing carefully away, her fingers forked to ward off danger.
"There is no devil in Woodstock," Tom repeated firmly.
"You have books full of strange sigils and magical incantations," Widow Beaton said, gesturing at Euclid's Elements.
It was, I thought, a very good thing that she hadn't overheard Kit reading aloud from Dr. Faustus.
"That is mathematics, not magic," protested Tom.
"Call it what you will, but I have seen the truth. You are just like them, and called me here to draw me into your dark plans."
"Just like whom?" Matthew asked sharply.
"The scholars from the university. They drove two witches from Dun's Tew with their questions. They wanted our knowledge, but condemned the women who shared it. And a coven was just beginning to form in Farrington, but the witches scattered when they caught the attention of men like you."
A coven meant safety, protection, community. Without a coven, a witch was far more vulnerable to the jealousy and fear of her neighbors. "No one is trying to force you from Woodstock." I only meant to soothe her, but a single step in her direction sent her retreating further.
"There is evil in this house. Everyone in the village knows it. Yesterday Mr. Danforth preached to the congregation about the danger of letting it take root."
"I am alone. A witch, like you, without family to help me," I said, trying to appeal to her sympathy. "Take pity on me before anyone else discovers what I am."
"You are not like me, and I want no trouble. None will give me pity when the village is baying for blood. I have no wech to protect me, and no lords and court gentlemen will step forward to defend my honor."
"Matthew, Master Royden will not let any harm come to you." My hand rose in a pledge. Widow Beaton was incredulous.
"Wechs cannot be trusted. What would the village do if they found out what Matthew Royden really is?"
"This matter is between us, Widow Beaton," I warned.
"Where are you from, girl, that you believe one witch will shelter another? It is a dangerous world. None of us are safe any longer."
The old woman looked at Matthew with hatred.
"Witches are dying in the thousands, and the cowards of the congregation do nothing. Why is that, Wech?"
"That's enough," Matthew said coldly. "Francoise, please show Widow Beaton out."
"I'll leave, and gladly."
The old woman drew herself as straight as her gnarled bones would allow.
"But mark my words, Matthew Royden. Every creature within a day's journey suspects that you are a foul beast who feeds on blood. When they discover you are harboring a witch with these dark powers, God will be merciless on those who have turned against him."
"Farewell, Widow Beaton."
Matthew turned his back on the witch, but Widow Beaton was determined to have the last word.
"Take care, sister," Widow Beaton called as she departed. You shine too brightly for these times.
Every eye in the room was on me. I shifted, uncomfortable from the attention.
Explain yourself, Walter said curtly. Diana owes you no explanation, Matthew shot back.
Walter raised his hand in silent truce.
What happened?
Matthew asked in a more measured tone. Apparently I owed him one.
Exactly what I predicted. We frightened off Widow Beaton. She'll do everything she can to distance herself from me now.
She should have been biddable. I've done the woman plenty of favors, Matthew muttered.
Why didn't you tell her who I was to you? I asked quietly.
Probably for the same reason you didn't tell me what you could do to ordinary fruit from the garden, he retorted, taking me by the elbow. Matthew turned to his friends.
I need to speak to my wife. Alone.
He steered me outside.
So now I'm your wife again, I exclaimed, wrenching my elbow from his grip.
You never stopped being my wife, but not everybody needs to know the details of our private life. Now what happened in there? He demanded, standing by one of the neatly clipped knots of boxwood in the garden.
You were right before. My magic is changing.
I looked away.
Something like it happened earlier to the flowers in our bedroom. When I rearranged them, I tasted the soil and air that made them grow. The flowers died at my touch. I tried to make the sunlight return to the fruit, but it wouldn't obey me.
Widow Beaton's behavior should have unleashed witch wind because you felt trapped, or witch fire because you were in danger.
Perhaps time-walking damaged your magic, Matthew suggested with a frown. I bit my lip. I should never have lost my temper and shown her what I could do.
She knew you were powerful. The smell of her fear filled the room.
His eyes were grave.
Perhaps it was too soon to put you in front of a stranger.
But it was too late now.
The school of night appeared at the windows, their pale faces pressing against the glass like stars in a nameless constellation.
The damp will ruin her gown, Matthew, and it's the only one that looks decent on her,
George scolded, sticking his head out of the casement. Tom's elfin face peeked around George's shoulder.
I enjoyed myself immensely, Kit shouted, flinging open another window with so much force the panes rattled. That hag is the perfect witch. I shall put Widow Beaton in one of my plays. Did you ever imagine she could do that with an old bell?
Your past history with witches has not been forgotten, Matthew,
Walter said, his feet crunching across the gravel as he and Henry joined us outside.
She will talk. Women like Widow Beaton always do.
If she speaks out against you, Matt, is there a reason for concern?
Henry inquired gently.
We're creatures, Hal, in a human world. There's always reason for concern, Matthew said grimly.
Chapter 5 The School of Night might debate philosophy, but on one point they were agreed. A witch would still have to be found. Matthew dispatched George and Kit to make inquiries in Oxford, as well as to ask after our mysterious alchemical manuscript. After supper on Thursday evening, we took our places around the hearth in the Great Hall. Henry and Tom read and argued about astronomy or mathematics. Walter and Kit played dice at a long table, trading ideas about their latest literary projects. I was reading aloud from Walter's copy of The Fairy Queen to practice my accent and enjoying it no more than I did most Elizabethan romances.
The beginning is too abrupt, Kit. You'll frighten the audience so badly they'll leave the playhouse before the second scene, Walter protested. It needs more adventure.
They had been dissecting Dr. Faustus for hours. Thanks to Widow Beaton, it had a new opening.
You are not my Faustus, Walt, for all your intellectual pretensions, Kit said sharply. Look what your meddling did to Edmund's story. The Fairy Queen was a perfectly enjoyable tale about King Arthur.
Now it's a calamitous blend of Mallory and Virgil. It wends on and on, and Gloriana, please. The Queen is nearly as old as Widow Beaton and just as crotchety.
It will astonish me if Edmund finishes it, with you telling him what to do all the time. If you want to be immortalized on the boards, talk to Will. He's always hard up for ideas.
Is that agreeable to you, Matthew? George prompted.
He was updating us on his search for the manuscript that would one day be known as Ashmole 782.
I'm sorry, George. Did you say something?
There was a flash of guilt in Matthew's distracted gray eyes. I knew the signs of mental multitasking. It had gotten me through many a faculty meeting. His thoughts were probably divided among the conversations in the room, his ongoing review of what went awry with Widow Beaton, and the contents of the mailbags that continued to arrive.
None of the booksellers have heard of a rare alchemical work circulating in the city. I asked a friend at Christchurch, and he too knows nothing. Shall I keep asking for it?
Matthew opened his mouth to respond, but a crash sounded in the front hallway as the heavy front door flew open. He was on his feet in an instant. Walter and Henry jumped up and scrabbled for their daggers, which they'd taken to wearing morning, noon, and night.
"Matthew!"
boomed an unfamiliar voice, with a timbre that instinctively raised the hairs on my arms. It was too clear and musical to be human.
"Are you here, man?"
"Of course he's here,"
someone else replied, his voice lilting in the cadence of a Welsh native.
"Use your nose. Who else smells like a grocer's shop the day fresh spices arrive from the docks?"
Moments later, two bulky figures swathed in rough brown cloaks appeared at the other end of the room, where Kit and George still sat with their dice and books. In my own time, professional football teams would have recruited the new arrivals. They had overdeveloped arms with prominent tendons, enlarged wrists, thickly muscled legs, and brawny shoulders. As the men drew closer, light from the candles caught their bright eyes and danced off the honed edges of their weapons. One was a blonde giant an inch taller than Matthew. The other was a redhead a good 6 inches shorter, with a decided squint to his left eye. Neither could be more than 30. The blonde was relieved, though he hid it quickly. The redhead was furious and didn't care who knew it.
"There you are. You gave us a fright disappearing without leaving a word," the blonde man said mildly, drawing to a stop and sheathing his long, exceedingly sharp sword. Walter and Henry, too, withdrew their weapons. They recognized the men.
"Galloglass, why are you here?"
Matthew asked the blonde warrior with a note of wary confusion.
"We're looking for you, of course. Hancock and I were with you on Saturday."
Galloglass's chilly blue eyes narrowed when he didn't receive a reply. He looked like a Viking on the brink of a killing spree.
"In Chester."
"Chester?"
Matthew's expression turned to dawning horror.
"Chester?"
"Aye, Chester," repeated the red-headed Hancock.
He glowered and peeled sodden leather gauntlets from his arms, tossing them onto the floor near the fireplace.
"When you didn't meet up with us as planned on Sunday, we made inquiries. The innkeeper told us you'd left, which came as something of a surprise, and not only because you hadn't settled the bill.
He said you were sitting by the fire drinking wine one moment and gone the next," Galloglass reported.
"The maid, the little one with the black hair who couldn't take her eyes off you, caused quite a stir. She insisted you were taken by ghosts."
I closed my eyes in sudden understanding. The Matthew Royden who had been in 16th-century Chester vanished because he was displaced by the Matthew who'd traveled here from modern-day Oxfordshire. When we left, the 16th-century Matthew, presumably, would reappear. Time wouldn't allow both Matthews to be in the same place at the same moment. We had already altered history without intending to do so.
"It was All Hallows' Eve, so her story made a certain sort of sense," Hancock conceded, turning his attention to his cloak.
He shook the water from its folds and flung it over a nearby chair, releasing the scent of spring grass into the winter air. "Who are these men, Matthew?" I moved closer to get a better look at the pair. He turned and settled his hands on my upper arms, keeping me where I was.
"They're friends," Matthew said.
But his obvious effort to regroup made me wonder if he was telling the truth.
Well, well. She's no ghost.
Hancock peered over Matthew's shoulder and my flesh turned to ice. Of course Hancock and Galloglass were vampires. What other creatures could be that big and bloody-looking?
Nor is she from Chester, Galloglass said thoughtfully. Does she always have such a bright glam about her?
The word might be unfamiliar, but its meaning was clear enough. I was shimmering again. It sometimes happened when I was angry or concentrating on a problem. It was another familiar manifestation of a witch's power, and vampires could detect the pale glow with their preternaturally sharp eyes. Feeling conspicuous, I stepped back into Matthew's shadow.
That's not going to help, lady. Our ears are as sharp as our eyes. Your witch's blood is trilling like a bird.
Hancock's bushy red brows rose as he looked sourly at his companion.
Trouble always travels in the company of women.
Trouble is no fool.
Given the choice, I'd rather travel with a woman than with you.
The blonde warrior addressed Matthew.
It's been a long day. Hancock's ass is sore and he's hungry. If you don't tell him why there's a witch in your house and quickly, I don't have high hopes for her continued safety.
It must have to do with Beric, Hancock declared. Bloody witches, always causing trouble.
Beric? My pulse kicked up a notch. I recognized the name. One of the most notorious witch trials in the British Isles was connected to it. I searched my memory for the dates. Surely it had happened well before or after 1590, or Matthew wouldn't have selected this moment for our time walk. But Hancock's next words drove all thoughts of chronology and history from my mind.
That, or some new congregation business that Matthew will want us to sort out for him.
The congregation?
Marlowe's eyes narrowed, and he looked at Matthew appraisingly.
Is this true? Are you one of the mysterious members?
Of course it's true. How do you imagine he's kept you from the noose, young Marlowe?
Hancock searched the room.
Is there something to drink other than wine? I hate these French pretensions of yours, de Clermont. What's wrong with ale?
Not now, Davy, Galloglass murmured to his friend, though his eyes were fixed on Matthew.
My eyes were fixed on him, too, as an awful sense of clarity settled over me.
Tell me you're not, I whispered. Tell me you didn't keep this from me.
I can't tell you that, Matthew said flatly. I promised you secrets, but no lies, remember?
I felt sick. In 1590, Matthew was a member of the congregation, and the congregation was our enemy.
And Beric? You told me there was no danger of being caught up in a witch hunt.
Nothing in Beric will affect us here, Matthew assured me. What has happened in Beric? Walter asked, uneasy.
Before we left Chester, there was news out of Scotland. A great gathering of witches met in a village east of Edinburgh on All Hallows' Eve, Hancock said. There was talk again of the storm the Danish witches raised this past summer, and the spouts of seawater that foretold the coming of a creature with fearsome powers.
The authorities have rounded up dozens of the poor wretches, Galloglass continued, his arctic blue eyes still on Matthew.
The cunning woman in the town of Keith, Widow Sampson, is awaiting the king's questioning in the dungeons of Holyrood Palace. Who knows how many will join her there before this business is done?
The king's torture, you mean, Hancock muttered.
They say the woman has been locked into a witch's bridal so she cannot utter more charms against his majesty and chained to the wall without food or drink.
I sat down abruptly.
Is this one of the accused, then? Galloglass asked Matthew. And I'd like the witch's bargain, too, if I may. Secrets, but no lies.
There was a long silence before Matthew answered.
Diana is my wife, Galloglass.
You abandon us in Chester for a woman?
Hancock was horrified.
But we had work to do.
You have an unerring ability to grab the wrong end of the staff, Davy.
Galloglass's glance shifted to me.
Your wife? He said carefully. So this is just a legal arrangement to satisfy curious humans and justify her presence here while the congregation decides her future?
Not just my wife, Matthew admitted. She's my mate, too. A vampire mated for life when compelled to do so by an instinctive combination of affection, affinity, lust, and chemistry. The resulting bond was breakable only by death. Vampires might marry multiple times, but most mated just once. Galloglass swore, though the sound of it was almost drowned out by his friend's amusement.
And His Holiness proclaimed the Age of Miracles had passed. Hancock crowed. Matthew de Clermont is mated at last. But no ordinary placid human or properly schooled female huech who knows her place would do. Not for our Matthew. Now that he's decided at last to settle down with one woman, it had to be a witch. We have more to worry about than the good people of Woodstock, then.
What's wrong in Woodstock? I asked Matthew with a frown.
Nothing. Matthew said breezily. But it was the hulking blonde who held my attention.
Some old besom went into fits on market day. She's blaming it on you.
Galloglass studied me from head to toe, as if trying to imagine how someone so unprepossessing had caused so much trouble.
Widow Beaton, I said breathlessly.
The appearance of Françoise and Charles forestalled further conversation. Françoise had fragrant gingerbread and spiced wine for the warmbloods. Kit, who was never reluctant to sample the contents of Matthew's cellar, and George, who was looking a bit green after the evening's revelations, helped themselves. Both had the air of audience members waiting for the next act to start. Charles, whose task it was to sustain the vampires, had a delicate pitcher with silver handles and three tall glass beakers. The red liquid within was darker and more opaque than any wine. Hancock stopped Charles on his way to the head of the household.
"I need something to drink more than Matthew does," he said, grabbing a beaker while Charles gasped at the affront.
Hancock sniffed the pitcher's contents and took that, too.
I haven't had fresh blood for 3 days. You have odd taste in women, de Clermont. But no one can criticize your hospitality.
Matthew motioned Charles in the direction of Galloglass, who also drank thirstily. When Galloglass took his final draught, he wiped his hand across his mouth.
Well, he demanded. You're tight-lipped, I know, but some explanation as to how you let yourself get into this seems in order. This would be better discussed in private, said Walter, eyeing George and the two demons. Why is that, Raleigh?
Hancock's voice took on a pugnacious edge.
De Clermont has a lot to answer for. So does his witch. And those answers had best trip off her tongue. We passed a priest on the way. He was with two gentlemen who had prosperous waistlines. Based on what I heard, De Clermont's mate will have 3 days... At least 5, Galloglass corrected. Maybe 5, Hancock said, inclining his head in his companion's direction. Before she's held over for trial, 2 days to figure out what to say to the magistrates, and less than half an hour to come up with a convincing lie for the good father. You had best start telling us the truth.
All attention settled on Matthew, who stood mute.
The clock will strike the quarter hour soon, Hancock reminded him after some time had passed.
I took matters into my own hands. Matthew protected me from my own people.
Diana, Matthew growled. Matthew? Meddled in the affairs of witches?
Galloglass's eyes widened slightly. I nodded. Once the danger passed, we were mated.
And all this happened between noon and nightfall on Saturday?
Galloglass shook his head.
You're going to have to do better than that, Auntie.
Auntie? I turned to Matthew in shock.
First Beric, then the congregation, and now this.
This? Berserker is your nephew? Let me guess, he's Baldwin's son.
Galloglass was almost as muscle-bound as Matthew's copper-headed brother, and as persistent. There were other de Clermonts I knew, Godfrey, Louisa, and Hugh, who received only brief, cryptic mentions. Galloglass could belong to any of them, or to someone else on Matthew's convoluted family tree.
Baldwin?
Galloglass gave a delicate shiver.
Even before I became aware, I knew better than to let that monster near my neck. Hugh de Clermont was my father. For your information, my people were Ulfhithnar, not berserkers, and I'm only part Norse, the gentle part, if you must know. The rest is Scots by way of Ireland. Foul-tempered, the Scots, Hancock added.
Galloglass acknowledged his companion's remark with a gentle tug on his ear. A golden ring glinted in the light, incised with the outlines of a coffin. A man was stepping free of it, and there was a motto around the edges. Your knights. I looked for a matching ring on Hancock's finger. There it was, oddly placed on his thumb. Here, at last, was evidence that Matthew was involved in the business of the Order of Lazarus, too.
Well, Galloglass drawled, sounding suddenly like the Scot he professed to be. There's always been a dispute about that. We're not really the shining armor type, are we, Davy? No, but the de Clermonts have deep pockets. Money like that is hard to refuse, Hancock observed, especially when they promise you a long life for the enjoying of it. They're fierce fighters, too.
Galloglass rubbed the bridge of his nose again. It was flattened, as though it had been broken and never healed properly.
Oh, aye. The bastards killed me before they saved me. Fixed my bad eye while they were at it,
Hancock said cheerfully, pointing to his gammy lid.
Then you're loyal to the de Clermonts. Sudden relief washed through me. I would prefer to have Galloglass and Hancock as allies rather than enemies, given the disaster unfolding.
Not always, replied Galloglass darkly. Not to Baldwin. He's a sly bugger. And when Matthew behaves like a fool, we pay no attention to him either.
Hancock sniffed and pointed to the gingerbread, which lay forgotten on the table.
Is someone going to eat that, or can we pitch it into the fire? Between Matthew's scent and Charles's cooking, I feel ill. Given our approaching visitors, our time would be better spent devising a course of action than talking about family history, Walter said impatiently. Jesu, there's no time to come up with a plan, Hancock said cheerfully. Matthew and his lordship should say a prayer instead. They're men of God. Maybe he's listening. Perhaps the witch could fly away, Galloglass murmured.
He held up both hands in mute surrender when Matthew glared at him.
Oh, but she can't.
All eyes turned to Marlowe.
She can't even conjure Matthew a beard.
You've taken up with a witch against all the congregation's strictures, and she's worthless?
It was impossible to tell if Galloglass was more indignant or incredulous.
A wife who can summon a storm or give your enemy a horrible skin affliction has certain advantages, I grant you. But what good is a witch who can't even serve as her husband's barber?
Only Matthew would wed a witch from God knows where with no sorcery to speak of, Hancock muttered to Walter. Quiet, all of you!
Matthew exploded.
I can't think for all the senseless chatter. It's not Diana's fault that Widow Beaton is a meddling old fool, or that she can't perform magic on command. My wife was spellbound, and there's an end to it. If one more person in this room questions me or criticizes Diana, I'll rip your heart out and feed it to you while it still beats.
There is our lord and master, Hancock said with a mocking salute. For a minute, I was afraid you were the one who was bewitched. Hang on, though. If she's spellbound, what's wrong with her? Is she dangerous? Mad? Both?
Unnerved by the influx of nephews, agitated parsons, and the trouble brewing in Woodstock, I reached behind me for the chair.
With my reach restricted by the unfamiliar clothes, I lost my balance and began to fall. A rough hand shot out and gripped me by the elbow, lowering me to the seat with surprising gentleness.
"It's all right, Auntie."
Galloglass made a soft noise of sympathy.
"I'm not sure what's amiss in your head, but Matthew will take care of you. He has a warm spot in his heart for lost souls, bless him."
"I'm dizzy, not deranged," I retorted. Galloglass's eyes were flinty as his mouth approached my ear.
"Your speech is disordered enough to stand for madness, and I doubt the priest cares one way or the other. Given that you aren't from Chester or anywhere else I've been, and that's a fair number of places, Auntie, you might want to mind your manners unless you want to find yourself locked in the church crypt."
Long fingers clamped around Galloglass's shoulder and pulled him away. "If you're quite finished trying to frighten my wife, a pointless exercise, I assure you, you might tell me about the men you passed," Matthew said frostily. "Were they armed?"
"No."
After a long, interested look at me, Galloglass turned toward his uncle.
"And who is with the minister?" "How the hell should we know, Matthew? All three were warmbloods and not worth a second thought. One was fat and gray-haired, the other was medium-sized and complained about the weather," Galloglass said impatiently.
"Bidwell," Matthew and Walter said at the same moment.
"It's probably Iffley with him," remarked Walter. "The two of them are always complaining about the state of the roads, the noise at the inn, the quality of the beer."
"Who's Iffley?" I wondered aloud.
"A man who fancies himself the finest glover in all England. Summers works for him," Walter replied.
"Master Iffley does craft the Queen's gloves," George acknowledged.
"He made her a single pair of hunting gauntlets 2 decades ago. That's hardly enough to make Iffley the most important man for 30 miles, dearly as he might covet the honour."
Matthew snorted contemptuously.
"Singly, none of them are terribly bright. Together, they're downright foolish. If that's the best the village can do, we can return to our reading."
"That's it?"
Walter's voice was brittle.
"We sit and let them come to us?"
"Yes. But Diana doesn't leave my sight. Or yours, Galloglass," Matthew warned. "You don't have to remind me of my family duty, Uncle. I'll be sure your feisty wife makes it to your bed tonight."
"Feisty, am I? My husband is a member of the congregation. A posse of men is coming on horseback to accuse me of harming a friendless old woman. I'm in a strange place and keep getting lost on my way to the bedroom. I still have no shoes, and I'm living in a dormitory full of adolescent boys who never stop talking," I fumed. "But you needn't trouble yourself on my account. I can take care of myself."
"Take care of yourself?"
Galloglass laughed at me and shook his head.
"No, you can't.
And when the fighting's done, we'll need to see to that accent of yours. I didn't understand half of what you just said."
"She must be Irish," Hancock said, glaring at me. "That would explain the spellbinding and the disordered speech. The whole lot of them are mad."
"She's not Irish," Galloglass said. "Mad or no, I would have understood her accent if that were the case."
"Quiet!" Matthew bellowed.
"The men from the village are at the gatehouse," Pierre announced in the ensuing silence.
"Go and fetch them," Matthew ordered.
He turned his attention to me.
"Let me do the talking. Don't answer their questions unless and until I tell you to do so. Now," he continued briskly, "we can't afford to have anything unusual happen tonight, as it did when Widow Beaton was here. Are you still dizzy? Do you need to lie down?"
"Curious. I'm curious," I said, hands clenched. "Don't worry about my magic or my health. Worry about how many hours it's going to take you to answer my questions after the minister is gone. And if you try to wiggle out of them with the excuse that it's not my tale to tell, I'll flatten you."
"You are perfectly fine, then."
Matthew's mouth twitched. He dropped a kiss on my forehead.
"I love you, Marleon." You might reserve your professions of love until later and give Auntie a chance to compose herself, Galloglass suggested.
Why does everyone feel compelled to tell me how to manage my own wife? Matthew shot back. The cracks in his composure were starting to show.
I really couldn't say, Galloglass replied serenely. She reminds me a bit of Granny, though. We give Philippe advice morning, noon, and night about how best to control her. Not that he listens.
The men arranged themselves around the room. The apparent randomness of their positions created a human funnel, wider at the entrance to the room, narrower at the fireside where Matthew and I sat. As George and Kit would be the first to greet the man of God and his companions, Walter whisked away their dice and the manuscript of Dr. Faustus in favor of a copy of Herodotus's Histories. Though it was not a Bible, Raleigh assured us it would lend proper gravitas to the situation. Kit was still protesting the unfairness of the substitution when footsteps and voices sounded. Pierre ushered the three men inside. One so strongly resembled the reedy young man who had measured me for shoes that I knew at once he was Joseph Bidwell. He started at the sound of the door closing behind him and looked uneasily over his shoulder. When his bleary eyes faced forward again and he saw the size of the assembly awaiting him, he jumped once more. Walter, who occupied a position of strategic importance in the middle of the room with Hancock and Henry, ignored the nervous shoemaker and cast a look of disdain at the man in a bedraggled religious habit.
"What brings you here on such a night, Mr. Danforth?"
Raleigh demanded.
"Sir Walter,"
Danforth said with a bow, taking a cap from his head and twisting it between his fingers. He spotted the Earl of Northumberland.
"My lord, I did not know you were still among us."
"Is there something you need?"
Matthew asked pleasantly. He remained seated, legs stretched out in apparent relaxation.
"Ah, Master Royden."
Danforth made another bow, this one directed at us. He gave me a curious look before fear overtook him and redirected his eyes to his hat.
"We have not seen you in church or in town. Bidwell thought you might be indisposed."
Bidwell shifted on his feet. The leather boots he wore squelched and complained, and the man's lungs joined in the chorus with wheezes and a barking cough. A wilted ruff constricted his windpipe and quivered every time he tried to draw a breath. Its pleated linen was distinctly the worse for wear, and a greasy brown spot near his chin suggested he'd had gravy with supper.
"Yes, I was taken sick in Chester, but it is past with God's grace and thanks to my wife's care."
Matthew reached out and clasped my hand with husbandly devotion.
"My physician thought it would be best if my hair were shorn to rid me of the fever, but it was Diana's insistence on cool baths that made the difference."
"Wife," Danforth said faintly, "Widow Beaton did not tell me."
"I do not share my private affairs with ignorant women," Matthew said sharply.
Bidwell sneezed. Matthew examined him, first with concern, then with a carefully managed look of dawning understanding. I was learning a great deal about my husband this evening, including the fact that he could be a surprisingly good actor.
"Oh, but of course you are here to ask Diana to cure Bidwell."
Matthew made a sound of regret.
"There is so much idle gossip. Has the news of my wife's skill spread already?"
In this period, medicinal knowledge was perilously close to a witch's lore. Was Matthew trying to get me in trouble? Bidwell wanted to respond, but all he could manage was a gurgle and a shake of his head.
"If you're not here for physic, then you must be here to deliver Diana's shoes."
Matthew looked at me fondly, then to the minister.
"As you have no doubt heard, my wife's possessions were lost during our journey, Mr. Danforth."
Matthew's attention returned to the shoemaker, and a shade of reproach crept into his tone.
"I know you are a busy man, Bidwell, but I hope you finished the patterns at least. Diana's determined to go to church this week, and the path to the vestry is often flooded. Someone really should see to it."
Ifley's chest had been swelling with indignation since Matthew had started speaking. Finally, the man could stand it no more.
Bidwell brought the shoes you paid for, but we are not here to secure your wife's services or trifle with patterns and puddles.